and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're taking a good long look in the mirror and asking, who do you think you are? We're tackling ideas of self. Where did you come from? What class do you think you are? How do you define yourself? What signifiers of success do you flaunt? A watch? A university education, perhaps? A ticket stub to the opera or an avant-garde rock group artfully thrown on your desk at work, maybe? We'll be talking to Dan Fox, who's written a book called Pretentiousness, Why It Matters. We'll be in New York City to ask cocktail barman what your choice of drink says about you. We'll head to London's Museum of Brands to find out how we learn to wear brand names as a badge rather than a label. And we'll speak to design guru Stephen Bailey about values, brand and otherwise. That little lot is all to come on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. So we're asking, who do you think you are on today's show? And first we'll meet Dan Fox, author of a new book called Pretentiousness, Why It Matters. Now there's a good title and a really good idea too. Dan Fox is talking about social mobility, that a working class boy who appreciates the avant-garde might well be improving his lot in life. We should encourage these people, Fox is saying, not pillory them as pretentious. Here is Dan Fox.
We live in a country where class is very much a neurosis as much as a sort of set of social and economic conditions. And I think quite often when people use this term, pretension or pretentiousness, what they're doing is they're expressing something about how they perceive themselves, how they perceive their own ordinariness or normalness. Because, you know, when you're calling something pretentious, you're saying that it's being something it's not.
It's inauthentic.
It's inauthentic. So in order to do that, you must somehow have a sense of your own authenticity. So, you know, something that's pretentious is somehow deviating from your idea of what the baseline kind of norm is. And this idea of ordinariness is a very, very powerful idea in the UK because, you know, it helps you sort of distance yourself from problems of inequality. You know, if you're being ordinary, then you're not part of the problem. You're not part of, you know, any kind of class that is, you know, oppressing other people or what have you. And I think that quite often the term pretension is used as a form of kind of class policing. It's a way of telling people to stay in their place and not to get above their station.
Well, that's an interesting idea, because reading your book and reading around it as well, it's a very thick soup that we get into, this idea of pretentiousness, isn't it? And of course, you go beyond the shores of the UK. And interestingly, you're based in New York, aren't you, as one of the editors of Freeze. We can go into that in a minute and talk about that. But we make the odd comparison between the UK and France and how pretension, we kind of, and you go back to the old Fawlty Towers joke, pretentious, moi. And of course, in a two-word joke, summing up all of our sort of hopes that we are and the fears that we're not, I suppose. Talk us through why you think, I mean, you've talked about it being a matter of class, but why do you think the French don't suffer? For example, the French don't suffer from ideas of pretentiousness in the same way that we do here in the UK?
Well, I can't really speak on behalf of the French.
But you can for the purposes of a radio interview.
I think just to come back to the British position, you know, there's a suspicion of, I suppose a bit like in America, there's an anti-intellectualism that's involved in this idea of pretension. The idea that, I mean, the way that Fawlty Towers joke, pretentious moi, works is that, you know, anyone that might be using a foreign language is demonstrating that they've got the education to be able to use a foreign language and that they must have an interest in the kind of country where there are celebrated philosophers and people who enjoy, you know, kind of fancy foods. So what it's doing is it's sort of aligning that person with a culture that, in the eyes of the British, doesn't share the same kind of, you know, clear-eyed Anglo-Saxon pragmatism and, you know, kind of clarity of thought.
Yeah, and it's almost fair to say that we live in a climate at the moment where you can be, there are certain strata of society which are constantly being enriched. They are upwardly mobile in terms of the size and value of their house and how many Range Rovers they have parked in the driveway. But there's sort of an intellectual downward mobility and a pride in that downward mobility. That's something you tackle as well in the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a sort of like downwardly mobile pretension as well, which is the, you know, it's, again, comes back to this idea of this ordinariness that if you kind of, you know, if you drop your H's or if you kind of assert, you know, how you just like to go down the pub with your mates, that's somehow aligning yourself with, you know, kind of normal
people. And an honesty.
And an honesty, yeah. But it's just as dishonest. And it also ends up kind of reaffirming certain forms of kind of class prejudice. The idea that, for instance, working class people might not have sophisticated ideas or be interested in very, very complex forms of art and culture and so on, which we know, you know, of course, is absolutely ridiculous.
And let's go back to a bit of your story, because you grew up in what you might call ordinary surroundings, but were interested in avant-garde, well, not avant-garde music necessarily. You like David Bowie, you know, who doesn't? And you liked slightly trickier books than the average, maybe the average reading age, or maybe the similar boys in your class. And you were interested in contemporary art, which is obviously borne out by your career now as one of the editors of Frieze magazine. And you use this quite potently, actually, in your book, that it was a misconstrued idea of pretension that actually equals social mobility. And you align those two. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that thought. Take that thought for a walk about social mobility and pretension.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to my background, I grew up in a small Oxfordshire town in, you know, quite an ordinary house, went to my local comprehensive.
Using the word ordinary is strange as well, because of course ordinary should be what everyone does.
Yeah, exactly. There I am, I'm doing exactly what I'm criticizing
everyone
else
for. When we
write
about it in the media, when I'm interviewing you here, we use ordinary to mean humble. Mm. Rather than ordinary to mean ordinary. We don't mean ordinary, do we? It's a strange thing, right?
Yeah, language is amazingly slippery in that sense. So, yeah, but I was lucky in that I was encouraged by my parents and the examples of two older brothers, to develop my interest in all things kind of artistic and literary and musical. And for me, my interests in things like avant-garde literature or weird music were never an affectation. I was just naturally interested in those things. These were kind of windows opening up the world to me. And with the encouragement of two great art teachers at school, you know, I applied to art school and went to the Ruskin School of Fine Art in Oxford. And, you know, there my horizons were expanded even more. And it gradually became clear to me that, you know, having an interest in these things that some people deem pretentious actually has enabled me to kind of move forward in my life and enabled me to kind of, you know, lead an interesting life. They're models of ways of leading an interesting life, and I think that's important. And I think that if you shut someone down for having an interest in movies or art or music because you think that's pretentious, you're also shutting down a potential way for a young person to develop their interests and another possible path in their life.
And let's come to the idea of sort of pretentiousness as a sort of failure of, we've talked about honesty and authenticity. Is there some way in which you can engineer this? I mean, you talk a lot about, you know, government cuts to arts funding and all the rest of it in there. It's incapable to talk on this subject and not, I think, include that sort of stuff. Is there any way in which you want people to read this book and take up, reading aside perhaps from the title of it, actually read some of the seriousness inside? Because it is a nice, flippant title, maybe, that draws all sorts of people into it and wants to start an argument. I mean, how much do you want to start an argument, and how much do you want this to be a book that can teach people how to embrace a bit of social good and add another zero onto arts funding budgets and the like?
I would be delighted if it had any kind of even, you know, small impact in that regard. I think the way that the idea of arts education in this country has been marginalised in favour of this kind of backwards Victorian idea that education is only about, you know, nouns and verbs and trigonometry, I think is a great failure to a lot of young people in this country, because there are a lot of young people whose talents and energies might be brilliantly channeled through drama classes or music classes or art classes, and those are being sidelined, and there are a lot of creative talents that will be shut down because of that. You know, if you tell some kid that they're pretentious for taking an interest in drama, then that kid is not going to, you know, have the guts or encouragement to go and join an amateur dramatic society, and then maybe follow a career in acting and then end up in the sitcoms that you love to watch on TV. You know, if someone doesn't go and do an art foundation course, then they might not become a graphic designer who then goes to, you know, design road signs or then goes to design, you know, useful things in our life. I think there are many useful things in our life that actually come out of art education. But the way it's sort of perceived and framed by the government is that it's somehow a marginal thing. It's just, you know, it's a frippery, you know, it's a luxury. And it's not. The arts are not a luxury.
We might almost say that the UK is a world leader in pretension, but it likes to call it something else, actually. We're far better at doing pop stars and art superstars than we are at playing football, actually, and all the things that we regard as being honest and authentic and working class and true. Are we not? I mean,
it's very true.
It's an industry that we make a lot of money out of. I don't know whether you put Adele in the pretentious business, but she's an artist. She sells lots of records. Perhaps she's more important than the England football team in terms of their world, standing on the world stage.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think this idea of like pretension necessarily means something that sort of like has to be complicated or over sophisticated or whatever. It's about having the, I mean, this sounds like maybe an over-sincere way of putting it, but it's about having the courage to follow your interests and not to be afraid of like risking creative failure in doing what it is that you're doing. I mean, this is the contradictory thing about this country, is that we love our great eccentrics. You know, we love the David Bowies or Jarvis Cockers of the world. You know, we love some of our pop stars who produce some enormously pretentious things. You know, like the Beatles. You know, Sgt. Pepper is a ridiculously pretentious sort of a folly in a way, but is one of the best-selling albums of all time. We love our, you know, fashion designers, and we love our, you know, comedians and so on. But at the same time, we're kind of also caught up in this idea that we're a very pragmatic country, and, you know, we're very no-nonsense, and, you know, we just sort of like to sort of get on with our own sort of phlegmatic daily life. And I think we there's a tension there in this country.
That was Dan Fox, author of Pretentiousness, Why It Matters, which is out now, published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and today's question is, who do you think you are? For the rest of today's programme, we're going to focus on the relationship between brands and status. To start us off, we decided to visit the Museum of Brands, Packaging and Advertising for a brief history in how we became so aware of the brands we associate ourselves with and what was seen as a seal of luxury. Reporter Lily Ames meets Museum Director Robert Opie.
So this is not just a museum of the story of brands, this is a story of our culture and lifestyle, because it's a context of how all these brands grew up. And here we are in Victorian times, and here we can see, for instance, the toys of the period, which were relatively expensive because they were intricate, they were expensive to buy, and therefore only the better off could afford them. But amongst the toys, there's the jigsaws, panoramas, there are books, there are magazines, and of course there's the rocking horse, which every well-heeled parent would buy for their children. Everything starts off as a luxury, and gradually over time it becomes a necessity. So in the story of toys, it's probably until the 1950s that they become cheap enough for parents to afford more than just a few. The brand is there as made by a particular manufacturer, but not branded as such. And it's very different from what I would term as the supermarket products, which are the daily products that we go out for our shopping.
So this is the second part of the museum. What are we walking into now?
Well, we're now in an area which looks at brand histories, it looks at marketing, and it really gives you a more detailed insight in how the consumer brand has developed and changed over time. And in terms of luxury, one thing that has always fascinated me is how, certainly in the 1930s, it was not seen as being the done thing to show your brands. You wouldn't have brands on your kitchen table for breakfast. Everything generally was decanted into something else, and the brand was never seen as part of daily life. It was a bit in for a dig. So the whole perception of brands has changed over time, and perhaps the beginning of showing off brands could be seen when people started to go abroad to the continent and they'd come back home with their luggage labels showing that they had been to Paris, or they'd been to Cairo, or they'd been to some exotic part of the world. And it was like saying, I can afford to go there. And it was seen as being very luxurious. And of course, over time, instead of the label of your favourite tailor being inside your jacket, it would now start to be shown outside. So you could say, look, I'm a sporty guy and I've got a favourite brand on my shoe or on my shirt. You don't know Black Magic as a name, do you?
I don't. What's Black Magic?
Well, it's a box of sweets over in the far corner. We're looking at a case in the 1960s full of supermarket brands, but amongst this case there are two advertisements which really show how they're trying to connect on a sophisticated level. And one is Black Magic, which came out in the 1930s, and we've got a wonderful photographic image of a woman with all I can describe as a real hairstyle.
You really can't get any more over the top than this. I mean, there's a fake gold frame around her and a real rose coming out of the poster. I mean, if somebody looked at this today, like that sort of stereotypical portrayal of luxury might do the opposite and establish it as not a luxury item. But it seems like this is really the birth of what we understand as classic luxury, isn't it? Gold, roses, woman with fancy jewelry.
Absolutely. And this is the last great moment when there were window displays for the high street shop, as opposed to the 70s when this window display sort of disappeared because they wanted to entice the would-be customer into the shop to browse more.
That was Robert Opie, director of the Museum of Brands, Packaging and Advertising, and he was speaking to Lily Ames there. You can visit the newly relaunched museum in its new location on Lancaster Road in Notting Hill. Head to museumofbrands.com for more information. Some people might define themselves by their favourite tipple. Are you a Tanqueray and tonic kind of guy? Perhaps you're the straight-talking bourbon swilling type. Or maybe your poison is something pink and sweet ordered in a hushed voice at the end of the bar. We wanted to know what bartenders think of people by the drinks they order, and also how a bar defines itself by the drinks brands that it sells. We sent Monocle's Megan Billings out on a bar crawl, poor girl, and she ended up at the Brooklyn-based establishment Extra Fancy, where she met bartender and co-owner Rob Kruger.
Mojito no sugar is the worst drink order possible. Thing with a bunch of soda in it, and they're like, they pretend that it tastes good. That's the worst. Because you're like, I'll do it, but it's going to taste terrible. And then they're like, no, it's perfect. Mojito no sugar, worst drink order. Margarita no sugar, second worst. Red Bull vodka is even way down on the list compared to those orders.
Okay, so if I came in here and I said, give me a martini, please, with Grey Goose, with a twist.
You wouldn't say that way.
I wouldn't.
You would say Grey Goose martini. Grey Goose martini, up, no vermouth, or you'd say Grey Goose dirty up, because a Grey Goose person is a confident person. However, that can go too far, because by the time they're on their third Grey Goose and soda, they're likely to order something like Grey Goose and vodka, and you say, you really mean Grey Goose and vodka? And they're like, Grey Goose and vodka. And you're like, do you mean Grey Goose and soda? They're like, that's what I said, Grey Goose and vodka. Because they're confident and sometimes blustery in their orders. And also vodka drinkers think that they can drink as much vodka as they want and nothing will happen to them. And that is not necessarily the case.
So Extra Fancy is a bar where anything goes. So you stock it all. Whatever we want, we can get here. But let's say you worked somewhere else that was a little bit more particular. Is there anything that you'd say, oh, we're not stocking that because we don't want that kind of person in this bar?
Well, actually, the only thing probably here is that we don't carry energy drinks. So it is always nice to be able to refuse to make a Jaeger Bomb or a vodka Red Bull or any other variation like that. On the spirit side of things, pretty much if somebody wants a Fireball, we have a Fireball. If somebody wants a Jägermeister, we have a Jägermeister. But we don't do Red Bull. So that would be the one brand where we would watch that line, because when you get into Jägerbomb territory and vodka Red Bull vodka actually is the wrong way to order it, but the right way to order Red Bull vodka, that tends to engender certain attitudes that we don't necessarily want to accommodate here.
Okay, so let's talk about whiskeys, because we're in Brooklyn, everybody loves whiskey, it's having a little moment. We actually did an interview about this once before. I don't know tons about whiskey, but I know that there's the high and low spectrum. So do you get a lot of people in here who want to kind of spit their knowledge to you about whiskey?
Well, as we say, whiskey ginger is the vodka soda of Williamsburg. So there are people who just don't care, and then there are people who... I think there's a lot of brand allegiance in whiskey without a lot of knowledge. So you've got your bourbon drinkers who, if you don't have their favorite brand, they'll name another one that's not even close. So, I mean, the difference between Maker's Mark and Knob Creek is huge, but the person, if for whatever reason you don't have one or the other, then that's the next brand on their list, and that's what they'll go to next. And sometimes people even jump categories just to stick with something familiar. Like those vodka Red Bull drinkers, if you don't have that, they'll go Jack and Coke. They're like, all right, I see how that's like on your list of things that you know about. It's not the same. It's not the closest thing. It's not even the same spirit, but that's where your mind goes. It's the next thing down. You have snobs and you have wannabe snobs, but we generally have excellent people here. So I don't know. I can't say bad things about it in a general basis. We have a drink on the menu called, or a combo on the menu called the Ultimate Hipster Girlfriend, which is a shot of well whiskey and a glass of rosé. And that's been very popular because people know that when you're just taking a shot, then it's not necessarily the most important to have something that's 12 to 14 to 18 years old, single barrel. It's like, it's whiskey and you're just trying to get there. So we have fun on both levels, I guess. I had the weirdest order the other day. A guy goes, sorry for the basic bitch order, but can I just get a mezcal Negroni? And I went, what? Well, yeah, of course you can have that, but like, what? Okay, I guess it is. Like, it's the most least likely to be a basic bitch order, but this guy had already taken the leap that something that's like on trend in a certain level is already passé. That was kind of mind-blowing, and every bartender friend of mine that I tell that to, they're like, that's hilarious. A year and a half ago, nobody'd ever done it, but like 99% of people don't know what a Negroni is and have just tried mezcal for the first time, and all of a sudden that's to this guy who's probably a bartender, like, oh yeah, that's the thing that, like, you know, you walk into any bar, just give me a mezcal Negroni.
That was Rob Kruger at Extra Fancy Bar in Brooklyn. Megan Billings is obviously having a day off today. Don't go asking him for a vodka and Red Bull anytime soon. And we're ending up Who Do You Think You Are back in the studio, this time with writer and design aficionado Stephen Bailey, who's written about social mobility very nicely, but probably also has some strong feelings and insights into how the things with which we surround ourselves signify both purposefully and accidentally who we really are. Here's Stephen Bailey.
I detest the term brand, which I think it's not at all helpful. But I know what you mean by it. I mean, I'm often asked to define what a brand is, and you know, even though having expressed my repugnance to the idea, one ends up falling into the trap. And I mean, a brand is just, for me, it's just the associations and expectations which you have of something, a person or a thing or a system or a belief. I mean, I don't think brands are anything new. I think they're just a fundamental part of, you know, culture, civilization. I mean, I think as soon as we emerge from the primeval glop, that was phase one, and phase two was rising to an economic status beyond that of subsistence. People begin to acquire stuff and use stuff because it tells a story about you, or it suggests meaning. The word brand has been around. Well, you know where it comes from. It comes from the branding horses, branding cattle, in order to give an identity to your particular herd. It's just become an overfamiliar word in business discourse over the past 30 years, but everything, I mean, it's been around forever. You know, Thorstein Veblen, the man who wrote The Theory of the Leisure Class, I mean, sometimes described as the last man who knew everything. He spoke 26 languages, for instance. In The Theory of the Leisure Class, he points out that, you know, what he calls the pecuniary canons of taste. At that stage, as soon as you've got money to spend, you spend it on things which have meaning and value. I mean, for me, forget about brands. I mean, my subject is, if you like, design. I mean, for me, design is not really what goes on at the latest furniture fair in Milan or Tokyo. That's a little bit of it. Of course it is. I mean, design for me is just how objects, systems, and people convey meaning. It's like nonverbal communication. I mean, that's what design is. It's the value we attribute to this piece of furniture or your sweater, my shoes, my car. That's what, you know, design is. That for me, you see, I don't see design as a debased form of fine art. I see fine art as a sort of subset of design.
Trying to get to the end of an idea, I suppose, by,
yeah, well,
by putting,
I, for
it,
me,
putting it in a frame. Or...
Yeah. I mean, for me, visual things have meaning. I'm absolutely fascinated by interpreting visual things. There's no such thing as a neutral gesture. There's no such thing as, you can't go around saying, I don't care about woolly sweaters. You know, I just put on the first thing I find in the morning. That's just a way of saying I care very much about what I found first thing in the morning, and I'm really terribly keen to let you know that.
Or we're almost getting into the realm of, I started out by asking you about brands and what they mean as signifiers. And I was going to ask you if in certain places we're in a post-brand world, the mark of a car, the maker's name on the watch face, whether in some instances we're in a sort of post-brand world, because you've kind of brought up the idea of stealth wealth, this idea of kind of not giving a toss, which is a very, there's no higher form of
the coolest,
of boasting and flattering.
Absolutely the coolest possible thing is to disdain these things, but then that's just like, it's still a way of projecting values and ideas. It's like the person who says, I don't like clothes, I'm going to walk around naked. I mean, it's actually just another way of expressing a value system. I mean, personally, I agree. I mean, I'm not a great acquirer. I'm not terribly acquisitive myself, but I'm very keen that everything I have should have, as they say, value and meaning.
I'm always intrigued by, I enjoy hearing Posh Spice's ambition, which was to be as famous as Purcell Automatic.
I know, she wrote
rather than Mercedes-Benz or Madonna.
If she actually wrote that line, which I want to believe she did, she's even more admirable than I thought she was in the first place.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a person who's, you know, we are brands. You know, I love that observation of Kurt Vonnegut's that, you know, you are what you pretend to be. You know, and Posh is a perfect example of that. And
yeah.
by pretending to be it, and by, like any good brand, if you're talking about soap powder or a drinks brand, any good brand is one which has it's a quality product and it's promoted with absolute consistency through the advertising and marketing, therefore requires meaning. And Posh is that, you know, she's done that with herself. It's a good product in the first place, but it has been consistently promoted.
As I say, we're trying to answer this question, who do you think you are? You said that there is no such thing as a neutral gesture. Is this burdensome when you meet someone at a party, you walk into the studio, everything means something and everything has been arrived at due to a decision of taste and economics
it's
as well?
Not at all, I know what you mean, but it's not at all burdensome to me. On the contrary, it's what gives life, you know,
it's a good sport.
Point, style, meaning and flavour. Design education for me is about, you know, reading the world. Yeah, it can be a bit fatiguing because, you know, walking down the street, if you have a mentality like mine, it turns into a bruising interrogation. You know, when, why is there so much crap around and blah, blah. But no, I love it. And people do. You know, my very first book was written so long ago. I mean, it was one of the books which started the 1980s design obsession. But I was just trying to explain simple truths, which are commonplaces, but seem quite exciting in the late 1970s. Holding a pen in front of the microphone here, did you know that someone actually made a series of aesthetic decisions which went into the creation of that pen?
We all
know that now, but I said, this happens to be a Mont Blanc, but it could have been a Bic or a Pentel. Or, you know, or a Fuji roller board. It doesn't matter what it is. But just that whole thing, I mean, this is my entire shtick is what I'm trying to, the design museum was about that, to trying to explain, you know, the meaning and value of things.
I wanted to ask you about print media, actually, and newspapers. This seems to me like as a soft signifier. I mean, it isn't a pair of expensive shoes or a well-known watch brand on your wrist, but something which you've given thought to. Do you think newspapers are still one of the last signifiers of taste, of the kind of person that you are?
Absolutely. Although I regret that distinctions are blurring. I mean, the English broadsheet newspaper seem to be in a rush for the bottom, you know, and increasingly less and less distinguished. But now, of course, walking around with a copy of the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung makes you look extremely well informed. I mean, my own personal preference has always been for the what used to be called the International Herald Tribune, now the International New York Times. And there's very simple reasons for this. Well, I'm terribly self-aware of these things. That you know, having the New York Times here at home in London makes me feel international. But then when I'm travelling abroad, it makes me feel essentially, you know, at home. Yeah, certain newspapers are... Well, it's any heavens above, we're in the Monocle Studios. Any print medium print media can define their success with how much they with how efficiently they identify with their readership, and that of course it creates a wonderful tribal sense. And tribes require, you know, symbolism and costumes.
Stephen Bailey's good, isn't he? And he has a new book out. It's called Death Drive, and it's out now. So who do you think you are? Well, that's a personal question, and I guess only you can answer it. But I do hope that a handful of interviews and field trips have helped to aid an understanding. There is no such thing as a neutral gesture, says Stephen Bailey. You always know who you really are inside. But is that the version you broadcast to the rest of the world? Maybe it looks pretentious from afar, but you're just trying to be better. Good luck with it. Who do you think you are? You're a listener, and we'd like you to stay that way. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was our very own pleasure principal, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.